very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. Kyle's over on the other side of the table. Say hi, Kyle.
Hi, Kyle.
We are actually at Moynihan Train Hall. If you have never been to Moynihan Train Hall, you really should take time and visit, because it's right in New York City, right next to Penn Station. It's actually a part of Penn Station. It's where you get Amtrak trains. And yes, from what I'm saying, you might be able to pick up the fact that we are about to get on another Amtrak train heading out west. But let me just stick with Moynihan Train Hall for a moment, because it really is a fantastic bit of architecture and just something worthy of European train travel right here in New York City. It's an open train hall. Just so many people are gathered here right now. We're upstairs at the Amtrak Metropolitan Lounge, which is where you get to go if you have a sleeper car, or sleeper room in a sleeper car. And they give you food, they give you things to drink, and you just get to hang out and watch all the people. So it's very relaxing, quite a bit of fun. We did something different this time, because we are hauling a bunch of cargo to the West Coast. We just like to engage in these projects. And it turns out, when you take Amtrak, you get 100 pounds that you can take with you for free in the baggage car. Now, you can't have a bag that weighs more than 50 pounds, so you can have two bags that weigh 50 pounds per person. And since we're two people, we did that twice, and that's 200 pounds we're hauling with us, and it doesn't cost a penny. And, you know, you can actually take more than that, too, and pay a small amount. But that was enough for us. The thing is, to do that required quite a bit of logistics, and it really was quite an operation, because we had to get these heavy boxes into the Moynihan Train Hall somehow. We mapped out the whole thing. We actually did some intelligence gathering before we actually did it. We went to Moynihan. We walked around, saw if we could park there. How do we get the actual boxes to the right people? And also, getting information from the people at Amtrak was rather difficult, because nobody seemed to know the answer. How early can you check a bag? In other words, you know, we didn't want to walk to our train that was leaving in an hour with 200 pounds of baggage fresh off the LIRR. No, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to bring it in advance so that we could relax. So all kinds of different answers on the phone. I realized the only way we're going to get the straight answer is to go in and talk to somebody in person, and that's what we did. We asked, when can we actually bring the baggage in? And they said about a day before is fine. You can even bring it in earlier than that, but it might go on a different train. So, you know, it'll go to your destination, but it'll go on a different train. So that's kind of funny. But it was, once we found that out, great. Okay, so now all we have to do is figure out how to get these four heavy boxes down from the street into the Moynihan Train Hall. And for that, we walked around the building looking for any kind of public parking. Didn't see any. We saw a parking garage. We figured, okay, we'll get a collapsible hand truck, throw two boxes on one of those. One of us will stay with the car at a parking garage while the other goes in and down the escalator or elevator or whatever to the train hall, and either checks the bags at that point or leaves the bags and goes back with the hand truck to get the other two bags and come back and do the same thing. Yeah, it was a lot to plan. And actually, fate kind of shone on us, because when we pulled over to try and figure it out while we were starting this process, we realized that we had accidentally parked in a parking space, a parking space that we didn't know existed, and a parking space that, honestly, it seemed to be completely free. Like, there seemed to be no restrictions on it whatsoever. It was one of these parking spaces that was sort of in the middle of the street, and it had a bike lane to the left of it, another lane past that, and there was a sign that said no standing. But I assumed the no standing sign meant the lane close to the curb and not the places where marked spaces existed. But there was no sign indicating what the marked spaces restrictions were. So, you know what? Don't look a gift horse in the mouth. We parked there. I ran in with two of the bags, went downstairs. I already had talked to the people the day before, so I knew the routine. I said, okay, we're going to wait here with the bags. Actually, Kyle went with me to bring those bags down, went back with the cart to get the other two bags. But then he got stopped going into the station because it looked a little suspicious to be wheeling in bags, and got questioned a little bit.
Wheeling in boxes.
I'm sorry, boxes, yeah, boxes, not bags, baggage. But we passed that hurdle pretty quickly, and then, you know, we were worried that it might exceed 50 pounds, but it didn't. And it was just very straightforward. We had four boxes, we followed all the rules, they checked it, and we were done. And we have little baggage claim things, and hopefully these boxes will be with us on the trains that we take across the country and will be waiting for us or meeting us at the station that we wind up at, which we have probably arrived at by the time you hear this. So I guess when we come on live again, we'll see if we lost the bags, if we got the bags, if the bags were destroyed, all sorts of possibilities. But I really think, based on what I've read, that Amtrak is a good way of getting baggage across the country. You can even send baggage without taking the train. I've never done that, but apparently you can use Amtrak as sort of a shipper. So that's kind of interesting. One day we'll have to try that as well. But we just got here to the Metropolitan Lounge in Moynihan Train Hall after taking the LIRR in from the island. And the thing is, we had to take the other branch, the Ronkonkoma branch, because this weekend on the Stony Brook branch, they're doing all kinds of construction, and it would involve buses, and I do not do buses. So we got to ride down to Ronkonkoma. It's good to be able to have a backup route into the city on the train. And I realized how cool that is. In fact, there's even another one on the South Shore. Riding in, it was just really cool. We stopped at the Elmont UBS Arena for the first time ever for me. Usually, our line skips that stop. And that's a new stop as well for the arena there. I was admiring the third track that's in place in Nassau County. Again, Moynihan Train Hall is absolutely awesome, and I'm thinking of Grand Central Madison, which is the new station on the east side, and I just realized how important infrastructure really is in this country and how amazing it is when it actually gets done. And we've seen so many projects come to fruition, and I hope this is the beginning of a lot more, and that we see more train travel, more train possibilities, all kinds of just modern stuff. You know, Kyle and I were talking about fossil fuels and how the industry is so anti-train and does everything possible to get people to belch all kinds of pollutants into the air.
Yeah, and it's just an incredibly selfish way to hog the economic activity that it would actually be many times more meaningful than if it was sort of as narrow as the forms of travel they want to achieve the volumes that keep them profitable. In other words, if there were more options and they were more efficient, they wouldn't be able to hog as much of the profits and economic activity, and their calculations and arguments against alternatives or just more transit and connectedness in general, modes included, ignores the potential for many more parts of the country to be connected to hubs that can then maybe put them onto forms of transit that are less efficient, like air or in automobiles. But they fail, their short-sightedness and selfishness really fails to realize the broader and wider spread impacts of adding to our transportation network.
You know, we've found that it's just so cool and liberating to be able to get around without a car. And in the Northeast, we're making steps in that direction to be able to go from one city to another and not be reliant on driving. There are many parts of the country, though, where literally every day, in order to get anywhere, you have to drive. And I think that's just sad because mass transit makes so many things possible, so many possibilities, and being able to, you know, in a modular way, just kind of interface with the rest of the county, the state, the country, other countries, that is true freedom. But a lot of us are kind of chained to the fossil fuels, and we have to you know, belch that out just to get around, get to the store, or to go to a different city or anything like that. And I think, you know, what we're seeing here with these kinds of projects being finished is just a reliance more on the public network.
Well, in addition, it's the market forces in the automobile industry actually forcing the issue of electric. You might be able to credit Tesla for really stoking that early on and basically forcing the manufacturers to look around and say, forget what these oil companies are saying. This company is about to eat our lunch if we don't wake up and come up with a product that can compete with it. And they did. And so to that end, I think it's basically the opposite end of it, where you have these public and communal forms of transport from one end coupled with the other end, where there's less actual market for the kinds of engines that their product in oil actually functions with, because it's moving towards electricity. And that doesn't really include the petroleum industry, because they haven't adapted and diversified enough to prepare themselves for an economy that is much, much more interested in that.
Yeah, you know, we were talking about this before. Basically, is this our train? No, okay. We were talking about this before, about how the fossil fuel industry is treating alternatives, whether it's solar, wind, trains, you know, anything that's not planes or automobiles, they're treating it with such hostility. And I realize, you know, they only do that when something is a true threat to them. If it wasn't a threat, if it was something that was just a pipe dream, they wouldn't waste their time. But the fact that they're expending so much to stop these projects and to make it hard and to make you more dependent on your car tells me that, yeah, you know, this is something. This is something that they're afraid of. And it's so short-sighted to be afraid of it, because, you know, they can still make a ton of money, but they just can't make all the money.
Yeah, and I think that from my days working in alternative energy and my experience with what it is to work in the face of those entrenched firms, you realize that it is not necessarily in their plan to cooperate. What they want is to get every last penny, much in the way the phone company does with copper lines. You know, they want every last penny out of that, and then they want, I think, a market position where they can dominate whatever's next. So they'll deny it, sabotage it, undermine it, over-regulate or otherwise thwart it through their levers of power until they want to run the next industry and dominate it with the same profits. And this gets into class and the idea that they ought to maintain their wealth, and that other entrants and other players that want to earn it anew for themselves don't deserve that opportunity. So they'll continue to make it impossible until they can't possibly profit any longer, and then they'll switch to something that either supersedes or is beneficial to their interests in a way that is basically designed for their benefit, right? Uh-huh. They won't cozy up to it unless, if they're not dominant. That's my attitude. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I see.
Well, I want to ask you, first I just want to note that we're still here in Moynihan Train Hall looking down over the crowds. It was a couple hundred people, but now it's easily 1,000 people that are here just milling about waiting for trains. But I just want to play some of the ambient noise of the crowd downstairs. I don't know if that came through, but it's just, there's something so calming about it. There's all these people just gathering. There's not a whole lot of frantic activity. It really reminds me of Gare du Nord in Paris, or the main station in Berlin. So many places where trains are just a fact of life, and you know, it's not something that people aren't familiar with. And I'm proud to see that happening more and more in this country, and I just hope it continues. But Kyle, I want to ask you, as somebody who has studied this for much of your life, why don't these companies, these fossil fuel companies, if they're so afraid of alternative energy, why don't they invest in the alternative energy and take that over?
It's a good point. I mean, partly because what they're already set up to do can yield them enough profits to stay dominant and wealthy, but also fund their own endeavors, or challenges to new entrants into the energy market. So it's like a rounding error to fight people in court that want market share or want to introduce things or want manufacturers to adapt to certain things, or, you know, whatever the argument is. I mean, right now, I guess Greenpeace is being sued by Energy Transfer because of the Standing Rock protests.
I heard about that, and I was trying to figure that out. I didn't know Greenpeace really played that much of a part in it. Usually they're out on the ocean fighting against whaling ships, but my theory is that they're kind of highly placed and might have deeper pockets, or just might be a more attractive target for them to go after. But I thought the whole thing was outrageous.
Totally. And to afford the lawyers to keep Greenpeace in court with slap suits and absurd amounts is, like I said, a rounding. It's not much money off the top of what they're already doing. When I worked for a long, I haven't really mentioned this, but I worked for a really long, a short period, but it felt like years, in aviation and alternative energy for some startups or stuff like that. And basically, some of the big oil companies would come and visit and want to know what we were doing, and certain parts of our process we wouldn't really share. But companies like Royal Dutch Shell and just some of the things like BP sort of does a little bit with alternatives. And many years later now, Shell is spearheading alternative fuels, and I think that's mainly because they're headquartered in Europe, and there's a different attitude towards that initiative there. But they're very much interested in who's doing what and what the state of the art is, but they're not reinvesting in it in the same way as they're investing in gas and oil. I think part of it is because the government has not made as many strident choices. Our entire defense system is based on petroleum fuel, so all the aerial refueling capability, all of that is petroleum based. So they have a very strong advocate in the federal government. So that's another reason why would they want to research alternatives? And, you know, I think most of the energy technologies that will replace this are going to be closely held because of the implications to upend what is a global oil trade run by cartels right now. And were we to say, like, oh, we don't need to, like, bolster this with our Defense Department because we have novel forms of energy, that would undercut the oil economy and take an enormous chunk out of what they can count on in contracts with the federal government, which are slower, longer paced, and really not the same as, like, the whims of retail and consumer activity. That's part of it. But it's really that, so those interests keep them doing what they're doing, and the investments will only go to making the oil fields not a loss, whether it's gas or petroleum. But they do watch, I think, mostly to find out if anybody's actually a threat and if they should buy the intellectual property, you know, that kind of stuff. It turns into IP trolling. Or they want to know, you know, novel ways of dealing with new forms of energy without having to pay small startups or fight them in court for their IP. And that was partly why in some of the places I was working, specifically with aviation fuel, you know, a lot of what we were doing was not to be talked about, because what we had done was new and at the time something that many of those companies wanted to be aware of. And working with airplane manufacturers and even the military to test some of that stuff, it was encouraging because you at least knew that beyond the major oil manufacturers, there was interest in research and bolstering this to a degree. But the costs, because it is energy intensive to come up with alternatives, more so than the bulk and the scale of the petroleum industry, made it hard to compete, and they know it. And those are easy ways for them to starve innovation and anything beyond what they do. But I mean, that's the short answer. They want to know enough to keep control, but they don't want to invest enough to anything else that would undermine what is so profitable in their entrenched and traditional business, which is fossil fuels.
Ironically, the trains that we'll be taking are almost exclusively diesel. So we are using fossil fuels, but I guess we're just not using enough of them to make the fuel companies happy. But you know what? I don't care if they're happy. We are moving ahead. We're advancing. We're changing. And we need to embrace that and stop kidding ourselves. You know, the planet is getting hotter every day, literally. And, you know, if we want that to stop, we have to really take some serious action that the planet notices and rewards us with livable temperatures once more. So we are here at Moynihan Train Hall. Our train is going to be called. It leaves in about 25 minutes. But, you know, there's all these people, there's a couple hundred people right below us where we're sitting in the Metropolitan Lounge. And they're just filing past calmly. There's no frantic activity. It's just really, you know, like a train station should be. And people meeting each other and saying goodbye to each other. It's really, really nice. And, of course, next to this is the hubbub of Penn Station and the New Jersey Transit Hub and all that. You know, we were in the city the other day, and as I mentioned, we were doing some intelligence gathering for this place. But it was one of these brutally hot days, and then like the skies just opened up and it was pouring rain. And you know what? It didn't bother anybody. Everyone was just going about their business, getting soaked, and it was just a summer day in New York City. The heat could have been a little less, and I certainly hope that we don't have many more days like that. But the weather changes are welcome, and hopefully the heat waves are over for at least now. Now, this is, you're hearing this on Tuesday, and by now, Kamala Harris has probably announced who her vice presidential pick is. So, we are broadcasting here from a state of ignorance, as we don't know, because we're in the past. I would say that I would like it to be Mark Kelly, you know, the astronaut. And he's a twin, too, so that can come in handy, you know, when they're short-staffed. But I just, you know, I think that he is somebody who's well-spoken and capable. Of course, it's not going to be Mark Kelly because I never get what I want. You know, when I, you know, wish for a running mate, it never works out. However, now that I've just said that, maybe I will have defeated the jinx that I have, except now I've called attention to it, so no, I blew it. So there's also Josh Shapiro, governor of Pennsylvania, definitely somebody who is passionate and well-spoken, a rising star in the Democratic Party. There's Pete Buttigieg, who I will pronounce correctly one day. He's definitely somebody who is spot on as far as being able to diffuse Republican talking points. So I think any of those three would really, really be good candidates. I'm worried that it might be somebody less known or less on the mark as far as attacking Republicans. And I think what they need is somebody who isn't afraid to go on the offensive. I mean, who was the running mate for Hillary Clinton? Do you remember, Kyle?
Kane.
Yeah, I didn't even remember that. You remember that.
Tim Kane. I almost said Dean, but Tim Kane.
Yeah, exactly. And that's my point. Like, these are non-rememberable people that don't really say much. And we need people who will say a lot. That is, by we, I mean the American people. I'm not part of the Democratic Party, but I you know, do believe in democracy. And I have been following this for quite some time, and it's been scary. It's been very scary, but also very inspiring because, you know, what we were talking about on this show less than a month ago was the opportunity that could arise from Biden stepping down. And we have seen that opportunity bear fruit. We've seen so much enthusiasm and good publicity and just a renewed spark that was so needed. We've seen the frustration on the other side because they just can't seem to get a good headline. Oh, my God. Trump appearing before the black journalist last week. I just cannot. I don't know what he was thinking, but they did not let him off easy. They asked him some pointed questions, and he did not answer them and took great offense and insulted them and then called Kamala Harris's lineage into question. And it was... it was really pathetic, sad, hilarious at the same time. But yeah, so whoever has been picked, which I'm sure we probably know about by now, okay, well, I guess we're off to the races. Next week is the Democratic National Convention, so that is going to be a blast. We're living in some really historic times here. And what happened to the train hall? The other side is completely empty now. All the people are on this side, but the other side is... are there no trains over there? That's weird. That's weird. Okay, so everybody's over here now. We're upstairs again. And the reason we're upstairs is because we're at the Metropolitan Lounge. And the reason we're at the Metropolitan Lounge is because we have sleeper tickets, which means that we sleep in a room on the train, which, you know, is very expensive unless you use points on credit cards. So a little tip there. But I think
that's how you're characterizing us.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
You just say we're not part of the slobby masses.
Well, I don't want people to think that we're, you know, high rollers here and going around just throwing out dollar bills everywhere.
No, that's like beneath us.
Yeah, it is. Right, we're too good for that. But I want to miss our train. They give us all kinds of free food up here, so I might get a bag of chips or something like that. I had a nice sandwich. I had a nice Mediterranean sandwich, which they complimented me for getting, saying that's very healthy. And yes, it is. That's why I got it. But it's just nice to be able to hang out in a place, look over the throngs of people, and you know, just be treated nice. And yeah, if you use points, then you're not even spending a fortune to do it. And if you are spending something, you're getting a room, you're getting food on the train, three meals a day. So it's and you're getting to see the country and getting to meet all kinds of other people on the train. So why we keep doing it over and over again, it is that much fun. Yeah, I'm not riding on a plane, that's not nearly as much fun. All right, we're going to probably head downstairs or just wait for our train to be announced. And I'll probably pick this up from inside the train. Well, picking up our journey a few hours later, we're just leaving Albany now, heading 2 points north. In Albany, they merge with the train from Boston. Both trains meet, the one from New York and the one from Boston, and add a few cars. We get a cafe car, we get a few more sleepers, I think, and coaches. And you get to hang out for about half an hour or so, though it was a bit longer this time, and walk around a little bit. We had some fond memories of Albany the last time we were here when we got stranded, but let's not talk about that. We have the night to go through while we travel through western New York and come back down. For some reason, the direct route to Chicago from New York involves going up to Albany and through Buffalo and all around. You know, if we had a better rail system, obviously it would be much faster and much more direct. But no complaints. It's fun. It's an experience to go through. Highly recommend it. And we expect to have a few hours in Chicago to walk around before we get on our next train to points west. And we're assuming our bag is in the baggage car. I peered through the window when we were stopped in Albany of the baggage car. I only saw one bicycle. I didn't see anything else, but I couldn't really see the whole car. So they've got to be there. I have faith. Yeah. So that's where we are. It's been really relaxing. It's been really enjoyable just looking out the window, seeing the Hudson River, and being able to walk around and stretch and just relax. We're going to have dinner soon. They have us seated, one of the later seatings, I think, and that's always fun. You usually get to sit with strangers and talk to them and learn some fun things. So this being Tuesday, again, we don't know what's going on in the world. We imagine that Kamala Harris, presidential candidate, Vice President Kamala Harris, has chosen her running mate, and it's probably what everybody's talking about right now, but we can't because we're talking in the past, and we can only guess, and we already tried that, so we'll see what happens in the weeks ahead. But we do know a few things about what's going on in the world. It's been a bit troubling. I don't know, Kyle, if you've been following the riots in England, but this is an indication of what the far right is capable of, what neo-Nazis are capable of. What happened in a fairly small city, known as Southport, I think it's in the northern part of the country, there was this horrible stabbing by some deranged teenager who killed at least two young girls who had some kind of Taylor Swift theme party at school. I don't know what the details were, but it was absolutely awful. And that alone is a nightmare for anyone to have to deal with. Some kids were injured as well. Some adults were injured. I mean, this is what happens in the UK. There are stabbings, I think more than what we're used to. They don't have the mass shootings, certainly not on the scale that we're used to. So call that a trade-off or whatever. It's horrible nonetheless, and steps have to be taken to keep that from happening one way or another. But what happened afterwards is really something that needs to be studied. It can only be called disinformation because it's intentionally distributed falsities that had to do with the person who committed this awful crime. Not that it matters, but these people were insisting that the person who did this was a migrant, an asylum seeker. Again, that should not make any difference. Humans are humans. Doesn't matter where you're born, where you're from. I don't know why that would be such a volatile issue, but it was, and it resulted in hundreds, maybe more, people in the streets, burning cars, being violent, and spreading all throughout the country. Here's the thing, though. Turns out the guy who did this was a British citizen born in the UK. So, it's all nonsense. It's all fake. But the riots are continuing and spreading because it doesn't matter. The facts don't matter. They hate people who are different. And it's this ugliness that is just fermenting in front of us. And if you look, the police seem completely unable to control it. You know, they're being injured left and right. Their cars are being burned. These people are running throughout the streets. It's like January 6th on steroids. It's truly horrible. And you know, you have to realize this kind of thing is festering below the surface, just waiting for a moment to break loose, and that is precisely what happened. And the thing is, the moment didn't even arrive. You'd think the moment would be when, aha, you know, that it's an immigrant that did this. They're all evil, but it wasn't even the case. This is somebody who was born in England, and they committed that crime. And again, doesn't matter. They're going ahead with their riots, and hopefully, by the time this airs, it will have quieted down somewhat, but that ugliness is there. It's right below the surface, and it's everywhere. It's not just England. It's not just the U.S. It's worldwide. There are all kinds of ugly truths out there. So we have to be on the lookout. This is why we're on the lookout for these kinds of things. This is why we care when we see people espousing white nationalism, or making Hitler salutes, or spreading all kinds of hatred about races, or about.
And our cafe car is now open and ready to serve. The cafe car is open. We're located towards the front of the train. We take cash, Apple Pay, Google Pay, and all major credit cards. And remember, please have shoes when you come to the cafe. If you don't have shoes, you will not get served. Thank you.
All right, as you heard, the cafe car is now open, so that will definitely be affecting what we do in the next few minutes. But anyway, this is why we talk about these issues, because this is the ugliness.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Offer some information. Still birthday today. When you visit the cafe car, make sure you wish him a happy birthday. Happy birthday, Phil.
All right, they all heard that. So, it's something that we have to constantly be on the lookout for, because it's always there. Truth doesn't matter, and it's dangerous. Imagine,
One last announcement, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, one last announcement. The cafe car is only for food, ladies and gentlemen. It is not a permanent seat. Once again, the cafe car is not a permanent seat. If you do go to the cafe car to get some food, please understand that this train is pretty packed. There are other people trying to sit in the cafe car to enjoy the seating as well as you. So again, the cafe car is not permanent seated.
Okay, I think those are pretty much all the announcements that can possibly be made. So I think I said everything I need to say about that. These things are everywhere. It's a danger. And, one thing I wanted to say was, people who are British citizens, again, not that it matters where you're from, but people walking down the street are afraid because of the color of their skin, because of their ethnicity, because they might be Muslim. And these are all considered the enemy by these hateful people. So I just hope the situation does not get any worse. It's really horrible to see, but it's also a wake-up call.
Well, yeah, the festering, I think it really allows those things to surface. We see them in some of these instances, but I am hopeful that people are paying enough attention and looking into how that stuff spreads and considering ways to mitigate it in the future. I'm really sorry that it's happening over an attack like that, and I think it's something that makes valid protests, and especially in our country, harder to do because people are tracked and kettled and abused themselves because stuff like this gets cited, and that was sort of probably a side effect of January 6th, that now people who want to be outspoken or active face even more surveillance and pushback by any kind of private or public entity that they think is running afoul of community standards.
Yeah, the cops said something interesting. As far as the demonstrations themselves, they said this is not a demonstration that's gotten out of control. This is a group of far-right extremists bent on violence and destruction and spreading hatred. And that is the truth. And that is a huge difference. We cannot let this quell legitimate right to protest.
Well, totally, and that's what I mean by looking into where and how these things spread. And I think really the only way to get on those platforms, if it is sort of private platforms and communications technologies, you basically just have to have people infiltrate and have access to those forums, and in a seriously deep cover kind of sense, not just I'm just a curious journalist doing a documentary.
And then you have the nightmare of the Middle East, which just continues to get worse and worse each week. It's gotten to the point where, I mean, we're talking about this, you know, a couple of days in the past, so God knows how bad it's gotten since then. But, you know, I honestly, I feel like throwing my hands up and just walking away. It's that hopeless situation when you have people in positions of power who clearly do not care about achieving peace, who clearly do not see the people that they have a conflict with as being human. What hope is there with that kind of attitude? There was a comment by one of the Qatari spokespeople after Israel went and assassinated a Hamas leader. Now, again, you know, Hamas, they're no angels, but they assassinated the leader that was negotiating the release of the hostages. You know, there aren't many people who were doing that, and he was the person who was doing that. And they went and they assassinated him in Tehran, in Iran, foreign country. They did that. And the Qatari representative said, how can we possibly have any kind of negotiation if one of the parties wants to assassinate one of the negotiators? How can we possibly achieve anything? And you have to wonder just how utterly stupid or just callous Netanyahu is to do something like that at this key moment where it was possible, maybe even likely, that at least some of the hostages were about to get released. I can't see that happening at all based on that. I really, really can't. The contempt, the arrogance that he shows, he and his ilk show, in opposition to what the Israeli public wants, it's just shameful. There is just no other word for it. And as long as he's around, I don't see any hope of anything getting any better. I do see things getting a whole lot worse. I mean, you know, right now, Israel's attacking Lebanon. They're apparently assassinating people in Iran. Occasionally, they lob something into Syria. It's just, how many different enemies can you possibly maintain at the same time? I mean, there is no question. These are enemies that are attacking the state of Israel, and they do need to respond in no uncertain terms. But what they have done since October 7th is turn the world completely in the opposite direction. When you kill 40,000 innocent people, it sort of wipes away the horror of what happened to the people on October 7th. And that should never, never have occurred. Those people need to be remembered, honored, and justice gotten for them. And turning into savage animals is not the way to do that. And that is what happened. That is what happened. The 40,000 people eliminated.
Gentlemen, now arrive in Schenectady. Once again, now arrive in Schenectady. Normal doors will open as the way you see a uniformed crew member. Again, now arrive in Schenectady. Not all doors will open as the way you see a uniformed crew member.
It's hard to talk about serious issues on an Amtrak train sometimes, but yeah, it's an awful situation. Honestly, my wish is that Elon Musk gets his rocket ship and takes Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin and Benjamin Netanyahu off to Mars and let us sort everything out here, because we got this. We'll figure it out. You guys are the problem. Except for maybe Elon, he might be part of the solution if he gets them off the planet. That would be something. Anyway, so I just wanted to touch upon that, because that situation is just turning into a real nightmare. And I mean, it has been a nightmare for quite some time, but boy, I just don't see how it could get any worse, and I don't see how it can get any better.
Well, that's the thing. Like, it was already terrible, and we thought it couldn't get worse, and it's like beyond any, and you know, here we are at beyond anything we could have imagined as worse. And like I agree, matching Barbary, you know, savage behavior with even more, I mean, it's tempting, perhaps, when you feel you have a moral right or like a must take vengeance and in return to dissuade any future attempts. But on the path we're taken, it's become beyond indefensible. I mean, that's why there's calls for ceasefires. Unfortunately, like, there's travel warnings for Lebanon, you mentioned that, and also I think I saw a headline that there's more U.S. military naval assets being moved into the area to lend more firepower to this. I mean, how? I mean, it's a mess.
Well, they're expecting a response from Tehran. There kind of has to be a response from Tehran for, you know, having an assassination on their soil. I don't really, you know, care about the Hamas people. You know, there's so much evil there. So, you know, while I expect that to happen, I'm wondering if it's going to be anything really that catastrophic, that major. It might be. Who knows? And then when that happens, things could escalate. But you know, anyone who escalates beyond this is a damn fool, because what do you expect to accomplish? The reset button has to be hit one way or another. And
once you hit the station, stop is connected. The only exit we see are track employee. That all doors are open.
So many things have to be changed and fixed. You know, prime amongst them is settlers who have taken over so much land that did not belong to them and have caused so much heartache and upheaval of families. That needs to be taken care of. That needs to be fixed. You know, there are plenty of things that can help support Israel, but acting like that in such an uncivil way is not the way forward.
But the thing is, atonement for that is not even in their vocabulary. Like, there's reticence to their behavior, right? It's just more. We're right. We have, you know, we are entitled, and there's no question, right? There's no further conversation about it, and it's just unrestrained.
And again, this is not the majority of the Israeli population who feels this way. You know, everything that I've read tells me that there is a much more rational way of handling these situations. It doesn't change the hatred that is coming from the other side or other sides. But this kind of reaction does not make it any better. Something more rational, although difficult, is the only thing that has a chance. There have been conflicts before, many conflicts that have been resolved. We shouldn't think that this is one that will never be resolved. It will never be resolved as long as this is how it's treated. People like Netanyahu are calling the shots. But if people stand up to the bullies and tell them we're not going to cooperate with you anymore, and if you don't respect the wishes of the people that are able to make a difference, you're going to find yourself by yourself. You're going to find yourself alone. And that's not what anybody wants. But this is a horror that needs to end, one way or another. Okay, well, with that cheery note...
ladies and gentlemen, the next stop is Utica.
And you heard that. The next stop is Utica, but not for the radio listening audience. The next stop is, I believe, the Blues Show coming up in another couple of minutes. We are on this Amtrak train heading towards Chicago. We'll get there early in the morning, and then we'll wander around that city for a little while, and then get on the train again. Hopefully our four 50-pound boxes are on the train somewhere. We'll find out. And we will report back in future weeks. And boy, what a pick for vice president that Kamala Harris made. I'm speechless. I totally am. But you know what? Everyone else is talking about it. Have a good night, everybody. We'll see you next week.
I trusted her all along that it would be the right person for her. And look at this. I mean, it's amazing.
Look at this. Amazing.
Have a good one. Bye.
Listening to WUSB Stony Brook.
Hey everybody, this is Tommy Castro and you are tuned to WUSB 90.1 FM Stony Brook.
Baby called up about a new place in the hood. The food was hot and the music damn good. Sat on the corner of 8th Avenue, oh, with an ugly red door, crack windows, no